Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. I was going to say before that the sun is shining, but it doesn't like me today. It's going to storm any minute, but that doesn't matter because this book just sort of fits the weather. Ha ha. Wouldn't you like to know? So I am live with John Land and Fabrizio. I'm going to make sure I pronounce this right. Bocardi.
Bocardi, yes.
Exciting because Dark Dawn, Dark Light Dawn is a collaboration, and this is really an interesting book because I love Navy SEAL Max Younger. I hope you guys are bringing him back. That's just a hint, John, again. Has an uncanny ability to survive any combat situation. And if you think I'm going to tell you more, think again. I am not. I'm going to let them tell you. So my first question to anybody that wants to answer, tell the listeners, and I'm doing this on my Facebook wall because Though 2 months ago I had some strange people in the chat room and I got rid of them real fast and I don't want to deal with them. So tell our listeners about
the collaboration. Well,
you're talking
to two strange people right now, so you might, but don't
get
rid of us.
Well, you got a third
yet.
One right here. From, that's okay, because you got a third there one pointing
okay.
to my nephews over here. They think I'm kind of wild and crazy, but this is a good thing. I don't care. Actually, John, the next time you see me, I got green, purple, blue, and yellow and orange streaks this time. That's really cool.
Okay.
Tell our listeners about the collaboration for this novel and both of your backgrounds. Why did you decide to write a science-based horror and scare the daylights out of me while I was reading it? Seriously.
I'll let Fabrizio take that because the concept was all him. I got to give credit where credit is due. We were working on, and I'll just set it up, and then I'll turn it over to Fabrizio. As you know, we had done two books in the Michael Toronto, the Tyrant series, The Seven Sins, The Tyrant Ascending, and then we followed that up with Black Scorpion. So in the course of doing those two books, Fabrizio started talking about this other idea he had, and I found it very intriguing, a little scary for creative reasons, since I had never touched on the horror genre before. But I'll let Fabrizio pick it up from there.
Yes, Ryan. Basically, you know, everything I do in publishing, I like to think is going to turn into franchises. I am that crazy. And I like to think that it's going to be more than just books. It's a very long process, but that's the ambitious purpose of mine. And I found a great author, a writer, John. We became friends. So we love to work together. We listen to each other. I obviously think he's a very creative author and writer. And I am myself extremely, you know, somewhat crazy. And I like to innovate and do something very different, you know, bring something different to the audiences and to the readers. And so my strategy is always to create books first, you know, to create the IP, to protect the IP, and give it legitimacy and credibility. And then obviously from there, take it to TV and films. We are doing that with the Tyrant series, and it's becoming a very big picture now. We have attached a big director, writers, producers, and it's about $100 million picture, you know, between 80 to 100 million. It's a very ambitious potential franchise. I have to say franchise potential because until you don't come out in the theaters, you never know. But it has all the ingredients. And Dark Light Dawn has the same potential as a TV series or a big film property. And we are betting, I am betting that it will be. And so I came to John with this idea of creating something very different. I like paranormal. I always been fascinated. I say it all the time with the with films and books of The Exorcist, for an example. It was very spooky and scary and intriguing and the unknown. It's always something that attracted me. And scare me, and I think a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of paranormal lovers that like this kind of stuff. But I also wanted to bring a new take about good and evil, and I always wanted to bring a lot of action. You know, often when we watch movies about paranormal stories, they are often about a house with a family and a ghost. or there is a priest with a cross fighting supposedly this evil forces, you know, of the universe. So we put that contest in a very action-oriented environment, and we created a new background story related to also the beginning of times, you know, the Big Bang, and this evil, which could be considered an energy, just like good and bad and good energy, you know.
And with that, what we did, Fran, was it wasn't enough just to do another horror story. Fabrizio's ambition is he sees things, you know, in IMAX. He doesn't see them on a typical mall cinema screen. That's just as a metaphor. And all horror stories are ultimately about good and evil. They're all about the nature of man. If you look at Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Frankenstein.
It's my favorite book.
Dracula. Yeah, and you know, Frankenstein is the ultimate example of that. Now, so what we did was we wanted to do something that not only depicted the battle between good and evil, the coming of the Antichrist, which is the classic theme of a tremendous number of horror films and books. We wanted to show the actual beginning. How did good and evil form? What is the beginning of this battle that started? And what we see is ultimately the battle between good and evil for mankind is really fought within a single person's soul. And I'll tell you, and you're going to be shocked by what I'm about to say, because you know that I don't... the thing that really hooked me about when Fabrizio was telling me his vision for this, for, you know, for the book that became Dark Light Dawn, it was the idea that you'd have all these great forces of nature colliding, ultimate forces that have existed since the dawn of time. But ultimately, in this war for one man's soul, which the winner of the battle for the hero, Max Junger's soul, wins the world, good versus evil, the real arbiter, the real determining factor, when Fabrizio first told me this, was going to be love. That at its heart, Dark Light Dawn would be a love story. Now, I say you must be smiling and shocked now, because I don't think in all the times we've ever done an interview, I've ever mentioned the word love or the phrase love
story.
Not
even Caitlin, and Clint
Wesley. No. And it was like, how could we take this ultimate horror thriller, because that's what it is. It's not. It has all the elements of an action thriller.
Horror action thriller.
I always leave out action. Fabrizio likes, you know, he has to correct me there. Horror action thriller. Yeah. But how could we do that, and also, and tell this story on the grand scale, that would be, ultimately. Could love save the universe? Could love save the future of mankind? And I think, too, at its heart, many great horror stories use that same theme. I don't think many of them do it as well as we did, but we do get into the nature and duality of human nature, which is what all great horror is about.
And Fran, also,
this
you know...
This is very true,
because
you kept me up at night and I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep after I, you know, watched some of the... Actually, Fabrizio, when you were writing this, you made the scene so vivid that it scared the daylights out of me, especially the prologue. So, you know, nightmares were in the picture. Seriously. Oh, God.
You know, another thing I wanted to add is that, you know, all this... the movies about devils and Antichrist, we've seen it before, Damien and... You know, it's ultimately the same story about the devil coming, bringing havoc, bringing horror, and trying to destroy the world. We already know the ending. He's going to lose. So we wanted to bring, first of all, a total different take, a more scientific take, and try to not give too many answers, because there's not many to give. I mean, the universe, what do we really know, Fran? Not much. I would like to challenge opting. You know, what is the big scientist here that tell me, some people say there's no God. Some other people say there is God. Honestly, I would like to tell them, you don't know anything. We just scratched the tip of the iceberg about what the universe is all about. You know, we just have now an iPhone and we think we know everything about the universe. We don't really know anything. And I don't think we'll know much in 1,000 years from now. So the fact of the matter is that we like to keep it ambiguous. We like to keep it mysterious because the less we give, first of all, the less we try to give explanations, the more credible we are. Because in reality, we don't know. I mean, as you know, you go to Rome, the Vatican have exorcists on payrolls, you know, and they do have this kind of issues with the evil spirits and all that, and they believe it because they have proved that, according to them, there's a lot of paranormal activity around the world. So obviously, some people believe it, some people don't. Fact of the matter is that we don't really know much. So we wanted to bring the story without giving too many answers because in reality, in the real world, we don't have them. And the fact and bring this this potential Antichrist that turned out to be actually a human that chooses by free will to love and because of his girlfriend, and he chooses to fight evil instead of embrace it. And that's the ultimate differentiator, because in every story about the devil, you know, the story and how he ends, you know, he wants to take, you know, it would be pretty boring. So we created this very complex fighting within to try to stop it. And how he, you know, he came about, that's also very interesting. You're not born to be, you actually, actually, it's not true, right, John? Because in our story, he was actually meant to be because of what happened to his father.
Fate is also a huge arbiter, a huge factor in a lot of great horror stories.
The other thing I wanted to add was to bring geopolitical events in today's world, because, you know, when we were writing this book, I was turning on the TV and watching people beheaded on TV, and I thought, these people, they think they're going to heaven, killing others, innocents. I don't think so. I think they're bringing somebody else. So we try to bring all these geopolitical events into our fiction, and created characters in the Middle East that they are very similar to very bad characters alive today. And all of which obviously bring, they don't bring God, they bring somebody else called, they bring the devil. And our guy was meant to be that person, but he chooses differently at the end of the book. So I don't want to give any spoilers, but that's the idea. And obviously we chose our hero to be a Navy SEAL for a variety of reasons, because action, I think, is paradigm in my type of entertainment and books. I like it very much, and I hope it translates very well for films and TV, as you can imagine. So sorry, John, to interrupt. Now it's all yours, the platform.
Let's see what Fran has to say.
Oh, Fran's got a lot to say. First of all, let me say hi to Cheryl from Partners in Crime, because she's listening as we speak. She's on the line, and she listens to all my interviews, and she heard it was you. I knew she was going to tune in. Seriously. Cheryl, this book is fantastic. If you haven't read it, I'm going to eat your heart out. Go ahead and get a copy. Seriously. Once I read something and once I review it, everybody wants it, and they can't have it. So let's talk about Ben and that first scene that scared the daylights out of me, because I didn't think he was going to make it out. And when it comes to diving and under the water, forget it, that's not me. So when Ben, tell us about Ben, and how did you create the pathogen and the first scene involving Ben and Denton and finding the rock? And I'm truly hoping, John, that and Fabrizio, that you're going to do a sequel, right? Of course you are, I hope.
Well, that's the idea. Yes. To answer that, you have to start with the idea that what we realized, because you never know, and I know you have a lot of writers who listen in on the show, so you never know when you start a book, you know, exactly where it's going to go. And what Fabrizio and I realized very early on in the process was that we were telling two stories. We were telling one story of the origins of where this, how it started, how this mystical, supernatural, paranormal rock, this stone, which lies under the ground, which dates all the way back. It's a remnant of the Big Bang. You know, it may or may not have been the thing that wiped out the dinosaurs, and we're talking about something the size of a fist. We're not talking about something the size of a meteor. And this is based, by the way, on the theory of singularity. In any case, we knew we were telling these two stories, and we chose to do it through two different heroes, Ben Younger and his son, Max. And the scene in the opening scene of the of our book, if people, if you remember, what Fabrizio and I agree on, and we might fight a lot, but and we don't agree on everything, but I think we agree on the fact that The Exorcist is arguably the greatest horror film, arguably the greatest modern horror novel ever written. But people who have seen the movie, read the book, forget that it doesn't actually open with the little girl. It doesn't open with the demon. It opens in Iraq at the dig site where Father Merrin, played brilliantly by Max von Sydow, unleashes something that he is going to have to fight again. So we wanted to create that kind of tapestry, that kind of epic quality. So we decided to set the scene, to open the book in the past, not realizing at that point that there would be sections of the book delineated as part of the past and other sections of the book, most the vast bulk of the book, as in the present. And that's where the ambition, that's where the scope of the story comes from. And this is true of all great, I think, horror storytelling. The Stand, I think, is the best. Stephen King's The Stand is probably the best contemporary cousin of Dark Light Dawn, in the sense that, again, you had something that was scientific going on, which is what we have here. We have this pathogen you asked about, which is spreading throughout the world, creating what may or may not be these zombie-like monsters, transforming, metamorphosis, transforming regular people into monsters. And we had this thing out there. So it was a matter of how do we explain the origins of the pathogen, and then in the present, watch our hero, Max, try to save the world or not save the world from it. And the key thing here as far as theme, the key thing here as far as the scope, ambition, and epic nature of the story is, the metamorphosis, the physical metamorphosis that those afflicted with the pathogen undergo is a metaphor for the spiritual metamorphosis that Max Younger is undergoing. The struggles within Max to become something else in order to either save the world or be party to its destruction. So there is a wonderful balance. There's a wonderful symmetry here that people find a lot when they read books like Firestarter, The Dead Zone, and The Stand by Stephen King. And I use those because they all have scientific backdrops that become supernatural, which is the same thing as our book.
And another thing
Cheryl just emailed me. She wants both books, by the way.
Of course.
just letting you know, she wants this one and she wants Strong to the Bone. But Cheryl, I have that one already, but she wants it too. Go on, Fabrizio.
No, I wanted to say the catalyst for the pathogen and everything and the rising of Max, it's all the human behavior. It's the geopolitical events that we live in the world, the evil that is happening all across the land, that brings that is the catalyst for its rising, that obviously decide not to embrace, and to everything else, and the pathogen as well to spread. And I like to say another thing is we like to, when we open up in the idea of the Yucatan and the crater where Ben Younger goes down, you know, when they were digging up the oil and they found this crater. And so when the idea is when we start, as you know, when we open the book is we started basically with the big asteroid. That I don't know how many million years, John, I don't remember, hit Earth and created the Ice Age. and created a dark light that, you know,
it was
basically killed.
Million.
Yes.
65 million years that kill all the all life on Earth. And the idea was that when you actually look at this big asteroid, you know, in our fiction, it was just this little rock that has that kind of energy that brought death across the land. And now, after 65 million years, Ben Younger touched it, and everything starts. And so we connect science to the beginning of time and to potential, the concept of, you know, hell or evil or whatever you want to call it, that, again, we don't try to explain, but we like to keep it mysterious. Instead of going into necessarily ghosts and demons and all those stuff. So that's I think it's a differentiator from a lot of other things that I have read or seen on, you know, in movies and everything like that. So I think
the demons and the ghosts and the stuff I can't take very much seriously. I've read so many of them that after a while they're all the same. That's why this one was so remarkable and so different. So Ben is a good character. For when he's in the book anyway. So when he realizes that he found something rare and unusual and he's reunited with the team, how come he appears to be so disoriented, and how come he was so far down? He gave me claustrophobia while he was down there. I didn't think he was going to get out alive.
John, you can finish this. I think the idea was to create this sense of being in another dimension. In fact, when he keep on going down, he feels like he's going down for thousands and thousands of feet, you know, like he looks like he's going down so much because the rope goes down and he's consumed. But he feels like he went down maybe only 10 feet or 20 feet, and it's all dark. And so we wanted to create that sense of mystery, new dimensions, and paranormal. You know, sorry, John, go ahead. You can explain it better.
No, I think that was, you know, exactly what we were trying to get at. And I think what you're getting at, Fran, is the fact that when you're exposed to something you've never been exposed to before, what Fabrizio said before about what we did was explore the nature of energy, that what if good and evil were actually entities? They were actually that had some form of consciousness that actually exists to survive, that does have a kind of will to go on, to endure. So this was a pretty ambitious concept, and what you're describing is when a person is exposed to something that powerful for the first time, obviously that's what happens to Ben. But what you're describing is when Ben is exposed to the energy, when Ben is exposed to the power of this rock, this stone that dates back to the dawn of time, he begins to change too. When he touches it, it leaves an imprint, a tattoo, a kind of scar on his palm. When his son, Max, is born 9 months later, even though his wife was told she'd never get pregnant, his son is born with the identical mark on his palm. What that represents is that the fact that scientifically, and here's the key, scientifically, Max's father, Ben, was evolving. His DNA was changing. That's the scientific aspect. The superstitious aspect is, what was he changing into? What fated thing is happening that the actual source of the good or the evil is meant to be his son who never should have been born.
And at the same time, his best friend and partner, wife, who also couldn't get pregnant, and had a girl. And that's, again, the fight. You know, that girl is basically Victoria that ends up basically saving the world, right, from evil, because she's the one that will take Max on the right path without knowing. So she's born the same day, I think, in the book, and the same
exactly.
And that again establishes again, the fight between good and evil. It's almost like if the Almighty looks upon us and builds an alternative for men to choose. And that's the idea. The idea is that we all have a free will, and we all can choose between good and evil. We can choose to take the good path or the bad path. And that's always been the theme of the book.
Yeah, she comes in later, but I have a question that's not on the paper, but I have to ask before we get into the terrorists. So when Max sees the imprint, because I knew there was an imprint on his palm, what does he think happened? Does he know that it was that his father had the same one, or does he realize what's going to happen to him, or that he's going to change?
It becomes at first when Max is a child. It's a source of bonding for his between the father and the son. They think nothing of it. It's just something they both of them accept because they're not aware yet of the truth of what's going on. But even then, you see in flashbacks to Max's youth strange occurrences when he was young. There are plenty of hints that something is going on that is not within the realm of the ordinary, not within the realm of the normal. And this is true of all great horror stories. They always have those hints that something isn't quite right, that something is just off. And then you watch the delineation, the deconstruction of the world around you into something different, which is what defines modern-day horror.
And I'd like to say that the father, Ben, start to have some symptoms and start to feel a little sick. And therefore, he starts to hire the best doctors to find out what's wrong with him. And he's concerned also about his son because he realizes that everything, slowly start to realize everything started from that day in the Yucatan. The day that, you know, they found that big oil reserve and he touched that rock and... the doctors start to establish that his DNA is slowly changing. So he gets worried. He worries that Max is going to have the same problem and he may suffer as he's starting to suffer and potentially die. But Max doesn't have the same transformation, doesn't have the same symptoms. He seems to be fine, and that's quite strange. But obviously Ben tried to keep... away Max from the truth, and he's very, very constantly worried about him, that he feels responsible for what happened to his son, what could happen to his son, you know, because he's starting to realize that he's, you know, is infected, basically. He's been infected.
Well, there are a lot of points in this book, too. So we're going to meet the terrorist from Iraq, and then we meet Father Pascal Jimenez, and he's roped into finding out more about this, and he sees it firsthand, and he doesn't realize that he's being used for other purposes. And then we have Ben and Denton, and he's not a nice guy either. So how did you create the father, the priest in this, and how come he got roped into going? He had no choice. He had to go to Cambridge and find out more about this, and when you describe what he sees, those were more nightmares, let me tell you. You could actually, the way you described them was so vivid that I could see the carnage in my head.
John, do you want to answer that or you want me to do
that? I think it goes to, you know, again, it's how we bring, the key to any great horror story is the characters in the book do not know what's going on any more than the reader knows what's going on. When you don't know everything, and in fact, the fun of this book for a reader is the fact that there are numerous viewpoints. You got it, that Fran. That's part of the epic nature. You have a priest invest on the trail of why of all these inexplicable phenomena that are conspiring together at the same time. You have Victoria on the trail of what has unleashed this pathogen that is a pandemic that could wipe out the world. You have, as Fabrizio just noted, Al-Qadir, and you noted, the terrorist who is determined to bring on the end of times. You have Max slowly coming to grips with the fact that he is meant for something much greater. individually, each of these stories unfolds, and they're all interesting in their own right, but only by putting them all together, all these different viewpoints together, can you actually get the total picture of the story. And I think, you know, you alluded to something that got me smiling about Jimenez. All great horror has a character who tries to explain things to the audience, who tries to figure things out. They're the kind of the eyes. We actually have two characters like that who are both skeptical, and they represent our viewpoint in the sense that they are trying to figure out what is happening. They're trying to create logic and sense to something that defies it. Some of my favorite scenes in the book are the priest trying to come to grips with what he's gradually realizing is happening. That finally, as an investigator for the Vatican's Miracle Commission, his job is to disprove inexplicable phenomena as the work of God or the devil. Now, for the first time in his career, he realizes that this is real, that he has uncovered something, an evil that is out there, an evil that is spreading. And what does he do about it?
And you know, we needed Father Jimenez, we needed this priest to bring the paranormal explanation. We needed a believer in these things that can give us the perspective of what paranormally is taking place. And then obviously we have scientists, and we have even, you know, army generals that they don't believe in that. They are more into the, you know, reality of things, that trying to explain certain things. And so at the end of the day, we only have to embrace what Father Jimenez's conclusion is, because being a man of the church, believes more to, you know, superstition and paranormal activity than let's say a scientist or anything like that. But so we needed this kind of characters to be in the story and hear their perspective and through them live their experiences in order to build the story and the mystery.
Well, I've got another father in here, but we'll get to him in a minute, because I knew there was another one. It's in my paper here. So we have Ben and Denton, and Denton is horrible. He's ruthless. So who is Oscar Beekman, and why does he have to do what he says? It's almost as if they're hypnotized. You know, Father Pascal, you've got to do this or else you're going to be sorry, and Cambridge told you to do it. And Ben and Denton tell Oscar that he has to do what they say. Why? And they're all afraid. I wouldn't be too happy with Denton as
Beekman
a friend either.
Beekman is another character who is very familiar to this genre. If for Stephen King fans out there, in the book Firestarter, there is a scientist named Dr. Wanless, great name, W-A-N-L-E-S-S. And Dr. Wanless is the character who is supplying scientific explanation to inexplicable phenomena. He is creating a rationale for what is occurring, which could not possibly be. And if when you have that, Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, created the ultimate definition of what makes this a kind of story like this work. He said, "It doesn't matter to me if you believe what I'm writing is true. All that matters to me is that you do not disbelieve it." And that is where the definition, the suspension of disbelief, comes from. Mm-hmm. But in order for writers like Fabrizio and myself to do that, to create that suspension of disbelief, we need characters like Beekman. They are devices, but they're also characters who convince the reader that scientifically something is credible, something is plausible. Here is the reason, because the thing about that stone, that rock that we keep alluding to, is that in addition to being the potential source of the end of the world, it is also an incredible source for amplifying energy. So an oil energy magnet like Dale Denton, the villain, would see that stone and want to exploit it, because he's discovered the ultimate energy source that could render fossil fuels irrelevant. That's the scientific backdrop that Beekman supplies the story, whereas we see from Father Jimenez the alternate explanation for what that rock, what that stone might be. And Fabrizio made an excellent point before. You're never really 100% sure where science stops and superstition and the paranormal begin. You're never exactly 100% positive. It's up to you to determine that. So it's kind of like this book is interactive in that sense. But characters have roles to play, and that's Beekman. And it's interesting because this book is wound so tightly. It's like a Swiss watch. It's so tightly constructed where every single page, every single scene, every single chapter is a smaller part of a greater whole. Fabrizio, correct me if I'm wrong. There's 100 chapters in this book or something like that. I don't think you could throw one chapter out without losing some of the fabric of what we were trying to do. There's no wasted space, in other words. Everything is a clue. Everything is another step in the unfolding of this cosmic mystery. But I never thought of it that way before, that you literally couldn't take one chapter out of this book, no matter how short or how long. You know? I never really thought of it.
If you follow, when we start the book, we have this big asteroid that at the end of the day we find out it's not an asteroid. It's a little rock that had that much power and energy to wipe out life on Earth. And we don't know where it came from. And the fact that, and then it created the dark light, you know, when all the dust was, you know, after the big stone hit Earth, you know, big dust and darkness that made the sun impossible to go through and therefore kill life on Earth, including all the dinosaurs. So we suggested that big asteroid, in fact, was this little rock. And imagine the amount of energy that could be, you know. And so when you read the book, you started to realize that. Then you figure why Danton would go to any length to, you know, find that rock. It could be very, very valuable. And then at the end of the book, obviously, the rock is still, unfound. But, you know, they found it, then it got lost again, and now opens up a new chapter, hopefully, you know, for future installments.
Of course.
Well, the way you ended the book, we can't tell anybody, but it leads me to believe that that rock is far from done, I think.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
how
still
come
there. Still around?
Vicky is a good character, but the poor thing, she comes face to face with the pathogen, the first victim of the pathogen, and something happens to her. But this was really cool, because anybody that knows who Medusa is knows that this is really scary. Why did you call this pathogen Medusa? Which was so perfect,
John,
seriously.
It's all yours. It's all yours.
The Medusa, as we know, was the Gorgon. And in Greek mythology, she was actually punished for her crimes by the gods. And and if you look into the Medusa's eyes, the Gorgon's eyes, you turn to stone. Well, Fabrizio, the big word, the word of the day is ambition. And we wanted, Fabrizio's vision was for some kind of pathogen that would create, it was the Walking Dead effect, that would create zombie-like creatures, but they wouldn't be zombies. It's because that had been done to death. We wanted to do something different. But we needed an army of evil, an army for the devil to make use of, to follow the normal line.
Well, not really. Sorry, John. Not really an army. I wanted to say horror in the world. Horror. You know, if the devil comes, horror comes. So we wanted to create a horrific environment that was about to be spread. It didn't spread because he got, managed to stop in the Middle East because of the events that happened with Max, but would have spread around the world. And the idea was obviously horror more than an army, because they're not responding to Max. They're not responding to Max.
No, it's not like the vampires in The Strain, where they're answerable to a master. And The Strain, by the way, is a brilliant TV show based on a series of books as well. But getting back to the idea of Medusa, what happens is, and again, this is a book, again, where the word for the day is ambition, but the theme of this book of Dark Light Dawn is really transformation, metamorphosis. So what Vicky uncovers about the pathogen is it seems to turn people to stone. It's their skin, their epidermal layers harden almost to a bone-like consistency. And what she begins to determine is that's happening because something is evolving inside them. Mm-hmm. Inside that shell, their entire natures are being transformed. So I had never seen this in another
species or something, a very ugly one.
Exactly.
And it's not really stone, it's very hard skin and obviously very ugly features like teeth and, I mean, horrific pretty much. We did a pretty good job to describe it on the book.
And again, it wasn't enough to do what people had done before. You know, I think Fabrizio rightfully pointed out that at times mm-hmm. when I took things a little too far, it got reminiscent of the Jeff Goldblum remake of The Fly, the classic horror sci-fi movie, made with Vincent Price years and years ago. But the thing about great horror sci-fi thriller, because the elements of science fiction are present in Frankenstein. They're present in Jekyll and Hyde. Classic horror relies on science as a MacGuffin, as something that someone discovers something they use for horrific purposes. You know, it's not just monsters from outer space and aliens and things like that. There's none of that in this book. You know, I get it's interesting because I write so many books. As you know, friend, because you talk to me every time I release one, I write so many books. It's easy to let them go. They're kind of like my children, but then they go off to college and I let them and they don't come back, and I don't really think about them a lot anymore. I'll remember scenes. I would say that this is a book, Dark Light Dawn, that has stuck with me in ways that other books haven't. Because when I go back and look at it again, and when I start having conversations like this, there's so much density to it, and there's so much I like about it, and there's so much about it I'm not really sure of myself. Fabrizio used a great word before. This is a great vocabulary day. He used the word ambiguity, dark and light together, black and white, shades of gray. And that's so true of this book, because characters – Max is trying to figure out his own nature. And yet, in trying to figure out his own nature, he's always on the run. He's kind of like the fugitive from the old television show. But one of my favorite scenes and sequences in the book, I'd like to hear even what Fabrizio says about this, is when Max first experiences the power that lies within him when he's just 18 years old, 17 years old, in fact. He's just a boy. And he's trying to protect the girl that he's fallen in love with, Victoria. And they go on the run together. They end up in upstate New York in the Adirondacks at a cabin. And what happens in that cabin is such a – not only a visceral scene in terms of what – a visual scene in what you see, but it's a visceral scene in what you feel about this poor kid who ultimately is finding out that he may or may not be a monster. How do you control the power that you didn't know that you had? This is why, and I want to get back to a point I raised earlier. When Fabrizio realized we had to tell this story in two different timelines, even though the present timeline is probably 70% of the book, 75% of the book, and the timeline in the past is only 25%, we knew we had to give the backstory of Max. What happened to him as a boy, what happened to his father, Ben Younger, after he touched that stone. We had to do justice to that story in a way that simple flashbacks would not allow. So structurally, we did make this decision that there would be three separate sections of the book entitled Origins, in which we would see how what we're witnessing in the present developed in the past. And I'll tell you, that's why when I think about this book, and isn't it ironic, as I'm talking to you now, there is a thunderstorm, a monstrous thunderstorm raging outside my window. I'm getting a little scared as I'm talking right now.
You should, because it's outside my window too, and I really don't appreciate it. And my sister who died always said she controlled the weather, so I'm having a word with her as we're speaking on her Facebook wall, because we're keeping it, telling her, Marcia Joyce, like, get rid of it. And the fact that there's a hurricane looming, and hopefully it won't hit any of us, yeah, it's getting dark out there. I think maybe the pathogen is coming to life. I don't know. So we have about ten more minutes or more or whatever. Let me not forget, 9/12 next week, E.Z. Rinsky, The Binding. You'll never touch the outside of a book after you read that. On the 13th, the author of Colorblind, and that's if she's able to do it, because she's in Texas, and I'm hoping it works out. 9/19, One Among Us by Paige Durth, and it's a very scary book about human sex trafficking and what they do to young girls, and she was a victim of rape. So she's telling the story as if it happened to her. On the 18th, believe it or not, Dr. Maxine Thompson has invited me on her show at 9 o'clock at night, which means I have to take a nap during the day, to talk about my book, A Daughter's Promise. On the 26th, I can't believe it, Andrea Kane, A Face to Die For. And to end the month, what's better than Tess Gerritsen? I know.
Oh, my God.
I am so... Yeah. How lucky can I get? And not only that, but John, D.P. Lyle is coming on with an FBI agent and Bruce Coffin and Larry Thompson to talk about how to present forensic evidence and police evidence in four different lights, including in the courtroom on November 9th. If you want to join that should be a riot. It should be fun. And, of course, I read A-List, which is fantastic. So tell us more about Father Pascal, because he's got a lot of roles in this one. I've got a whole bunch of questions for him. So he plays a lot of roles, and we have the organization of WHO, World Health Organization, the CDC, who tries to stop the pathogen. And that's what's really cool, because, you know, what could you do if you can't really do it? And so what is Father Pascal not to want to be part of this? He just wants to stay out of it, as Father Jimenez did, and he sort of has no choice. And he realizes that someone in his past is evil, and someone in his present wants to take him out. How come?
Father Jimenez.
John, you want
to? Well, yeah. Father Jimenez was one of the first characters when Fabrizio was talking about his passion for the story. Father Jimenez was one of the first characters he mentioned. And the idea that a man, and this is, it may in some ways be cliche, but a man who's come to question his faith comes to realize that everything he was taught over the years, everything he's experienced, but this is the key with Father Jimenez. It's not Father Jimenez has been involved in this since the, you know, dating back many, many years. His role in this is also a matter of fate. Father Jimenez years ago was exposed to this at the beginning of the process that's going on, not long after Ben Younger found the stone. Father Jimenez's involvement began as, you know, as a scientist, not as a priest. He becomes
a priest.
He
was a scientist. As a result of something that saved his life, and he thought that that was the will of God.
Exactly.
Basically, he was about to be killed, beheaded by a crazy man, which happens to be then the terrorist that becomes the terrorist. He was an SIS soldier, fanatic from Chechnya that joined the SIS and happens to be in this mission expedition in the middle of nowhere in Nigeria for the UK government. And he was a scientist in that mission. And there is a series of events. There is a lot of action. And this guy turns and basically kill everybody. And is about to kill Father Jimenez. I mean, not Father Jimenez. It was not Father Jimenez. It was kill Pascal, a scientist, the head of the expedition for the scientific expedition. and basically put the knife in his throat, and he says, you know, you are a Christian, because he sees that he has a cross in his neck. So why don't you ask your God to come and save you? If you give me a sign, I'll let you live. And he closes his eyes and he prays, and he says, this is the end. He's about to, you know, he's about to feel the cut in his throat, but it never happens. He opened his eyes, and it's all dark. There is an eclipse. And the eclipse, basically, he turned around, the man is gone. That was the sign. And that was the event that made him become a priest. So,
and from a structural standpoint, during that eclipse, both Max and Victoria, our two heroes, are born.
Mm-hmm.
So there is so much cosmic going on. And when you talk about Father Jimenez, if you think back to the classic horror film Halloween, we have Dr. Loomis,
mm-hmm.
our voice, explaining to us the nature of the evil. In the classic, in one of my favorite things ever, Game of Thrones, which just concluded the season brilliantly a few weeks ago, you have Tully, the Meister, the book guy, the overweight man who is the one who killed a White Walker and now has the books that can help Jon Snow figure out how to win the war against the army of the dead. He's the one who understands the scientific nature, or tries to understand the nature of what is really happening. They're, these characters throughout fiction are not necessarily traditional heroes. They're more anti-heroes or sub-characters, and that's what Jimenez does. He's the Dr. Loomis. He's the Tully. He's the part of the book that bridges, and this is the best way I can put it, bridges the science and the superstition. In him, in other characters, it's one or the other. In Father Jimenez, it's both. He sees the science, he sees the superstition, and he sees the commonality between the two of them. He's the one who starts to make the connection that these two things, are, that these two natures are connected. And that's where I think that the great thing about this book, Fran, and I think thriller readers can embrace it. I think my regular audience will embrace it for the action. But I think horror, you know, lovers of horror out there, and I got to tell you, I love good horror. The problem is there isn't a lot of good horror out there. I love being scared. I read Joe Hill's Heart-Shaped Box and Nosferatu, and I was literally, I literally had nightmares from those books. I read Dr. Sleep, Stephen King's brilliant sequel to The Shining, and I'm still, I still rave about what I read in that book. But as much as I want to find more horror, by the likes of Robert R. McCammon, you know, who wrote some of the great modern horror novels, there just isn't a lot of it out there. And I think what Fabrizio and I wanted to do was create a modern horror, quote, action thriller that would make horror accessible, that would make horror more mainstream. Because very few horror writers, with the exception of Stephen King, Dean Koontz doesn't write horror anymore, very few of them are mainstream best-selling authors. But in Dark Light Dawn, we have, we've put horror in the tapestry of a much more familiar thriller kind of format. The same way, in some sense, that James Rollins does in his great books. The same way that Doug Preston has done a few times in books like the, you know, The Kraken Project and Blasphemy. These are, in terms of scope and scale, again, here's that word, ambition. They're trying to be like Dark Light Dawn, much more than an ordinary great read. They're trying to be something that you're going to remember long after you put the book down.
You're definitely right about that, but I could tell you this. Tess Gerrinson's book, you have to read it, I Know a Secret. And she bases her horror based on a saints, different saints. That's all I'm going to say. And she scared me too, because the carnage and what Rizzoli and Isles have to handle is just so different that than anything else that she's ever written before. So she's really taking a chance on this one. I think the book is fantastic, but then Dark Light Dawn scared me more. So before we end, I just realized that you're starting out with darkness, right? and you can't see, almost like a black night, almost like the sky outside that I can't stand. And then all of a sudden the sun comes out, and then all of a sudden you're across between day and night. How did you decide to do that as the title of the book? Because that's what it looks like to me. All of a sudden different shades of maybe darkness or horror, and then all of a sudden Father Jimenez and everybody else sort of sees what's going to happen, and then it goes back into the dawn where you're just starting out again. I just thought of that.
Because I wanted to answer this, John, because for two reasons. Number one, because there are two reasons for that. Number one, dark light dawn. It's the beginning of a new era. The reason why is because Max, in this book, is in among us now. You know, basically the potential of having the rise of the devil. You know, and if moving forward with this property, we anticipate the fact of the thing is God gave us a chance, but the clock is ticking, you know, and it's still here, and there will always be the struggle going forward. And dark light is because it's darkness, but it's also light at the same time, so he's ambiguous. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be an angel, it can be a demon. It can bring hell on earth, or it can bring peace. And then also it's the connotation with this big asteroid that end up actually being only a rock in our fiction that brought death, you know, on earth, you know, during the Ice Age and the 65 million years ago, build that dark light environment that basically killed all life. So there is that two connotations. That light, that's why we like to call it dark light and dawn, because it's obviously the beginning. Sorry, John, now you're your turn.
No, that's exactly how I would have said it, and I would only add that dark light is kind of symbolic of what I was alluding to before about the duality of human nature. Frankenstein and the monster, Jekyll and Hyde, the two... the good and evil that are raging inside Max, battling for control of his soul and thus for control of the world. Dark light. It's an oxymoron. It doesn't seem, how can you have dark light? Well, we all have both darkness and light inside us. And finding the right balance determines success, happiness, contentment. It's really, you know, it's this is a... I'd say a big, bold story that tells a very metaphorical tale that really gets to the nature of man. The more I talk about this book, the more I like it, the more I realize that I have no idea how, from where we started, we ended up with something of this scope and scale, this epic nature. Then again, if you've read the two books we did in the Tyrant series, you got an idea that ambition in the books that we work on is pretty common.
Well, I still want you to bring back my other favorite character, because the last book you wrote sort of had a touch of horror and Dracula in it too. So that's just a hint, because I really liked it. And John knows who I'm talking about. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So
glad.
Before we end, who created the ending? And this rock... I don't think I would want to touch it. I would be afraid. If the rock could talk, what would the rock tell us about its future and the future
oh, wow.
of the world? And I think Max has his own, you know, view. I think he becomes invincible. He's really, really powerful. And there's one scene where he has to really prove, maybe because of this rock, that he could just, you know, save Victoria. But if Max could talk, what would he tell you is the future of the rock and the future of the world, if the rock could talk? Because I think The Rock owns the story. He's the main guy.
Wow,
like
The Rock.
That. I like John. if you remember, the Rock, Max knows what happened to his father, but there's no connotations. There's no connection between Max and The Rock in the present. Max is not trying to find The Rock. That was Denton. That was secretly trying to discover a new source of energy that could change, you know, the world, and obviously that killed them. But Max basically knows only what happened to his father, and because he has that mark, but he doesn't know where the rock is. It's out there. And my take on the rock is temptation. The rock is evil. The rock comes from somewhere in the universe that we may can, that in superstition we can define as hell, or comes from an unknown place that basically is here now for reasons that we can't explain, maybe faith, and is here to instigate evil on planet Earth among humans, humanity. And it strives every time there is evil in the world. That's why we brought it into geopolitical events, our fiction, mix it, blend it, and that's what the rock represents. That now is at the bottom of the what is the fault, John? I forgot the name. At the bottom of the ocean.
Oh, the Mariana Trench.
Yeah,
he's on the Mariana Trench.
Is your last paragraph, the last page.
But we won't
tell
you.
Yeah, that's what it is.
And I love that
somebody,
last line.
Yeah.
I love that last line on this page. Because, see, I keep the book in front of me, people. The effect created a strange hue that could best be described as neither light or darkness, more like dark light. And that's on page 428. And I'm not going to tell you the next page because then you'll get the fact that there's going to be a sequel. So, John, tell us, we're over the hour, but so what? We don't care. What is next for both of you? When will there be a sequel? And I'm going to read Strong to the Bone very soon. It's on my list of, we have to read it and set up another interview. I get that. So tell us more about it and tell us what's next for both of you. And when am I getting the next one?
Well, you just said what's next for me is the next Caitlin Strong book, Strong to the Bone, coming in December.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I'll leave it to Fabrizio to talk about the future of the series because, as he said, it's the point of this is that it's not they aren't just books. They're meant to be far. They're meant to be the launching of franchises, of brands. So there, it's not as simple a question to answer as to when sequels follow, because it's there's so much more. But I'll let Fabrizio touch that one, and for people who enjoy my Caitlin Strong series, December 5th, they're gonna have a blast with Strong to the Bone. It is a great story, and there are monsters in Strong to the Bone too. They just have flesh and blood. And they don't get affected by pathogens or anything else. It's nature. It's human nature itself where the evil lies. So
well,
it's a little different.
I've got it in my calendar that's the day that I'll post the review. I have that. See, I do have it right there. That it's coming out, and I know that I'm going to post the review that day as soon as I remember to do it. Yes, if I don't put it in my phone, it doesn't get done. So, Fabrizio, what's next?
So, you know, as you know, Fran, or probably know, I have a lot of investments and I am a financier. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, I'm making the Tyrant Knight, now we call him, in the comics and in the film, into a motion picture, a very expensive one.
Nice.
With a big studio. I can't wait for that to happen. We have announced it for 2019. We should be in production or pre-production sometime next year. Making films, big motion pictures, it's a very difficult to make them successful, very daunting, mm-hmm. you know, effort, because you have a lot of collaborative efforts and you need to agree with a lot of people. You need distribution, you need directors, you need casting, top casting. I believe in top casting. One of those that will choose casting very carefully. So to make a long story short, I have done this book with John because I believe that it's franchise potential for either TV or films. And now that we have finished, just completed this first book, we are focusing on developing it now into a TV show, a very exciting TV series, or a first film. And as soon as we have identified that step, which may take us about a year, we will then decide about the future of the series. Obviously, I'm talking about the book series. Obviously, we anticipate we will write more, but the timing of that will depend on a on how everything developed in media. Because today, in today's world, in order to license the property worldwide and make it a big book property, you need potentially, necessarily actually, a film, successful film or TV series. That's a fact. I mean, a lot of people around the world is, you know, interest to license Tyrant. We have been licensing it in other countries for books, but everybody have made offers already subject to a film being made. So that's how people react. I mean, I like to remind everybody that James Bond wasn't anywhere close to what he is today without a film, the first film, you know, in books. They were not, Ian Fleming was not selling millions of copies until it became a film. So we are, you know, very confident we will become Dark Light Dawn much more than a book series. And we anticipate, you know, with John developing the next one, the next book, as soon as we make some progress, hopefully within next year with the media property in TV or films, and obviously market then the books accordingly. Okay, in fact, we'll probably do another Tyrant book as soon as we announce the filming production with the casting, which we anticipate to be extremely exciting and quite big, you know, top casting. I believe in top casting, Fran. You know, this today movie.
Well, I have to tell you before you go and before we end that you have a whole bunch of authors that are listening to the show that are going to tune in after the show. A whole bunch of very wonderful authors that John might know. And they're going to listen to the show afterwards. And Barbara Nicholas is one of them. And I just emailed her, said, "Oh, please send me your new book." And there's a whole bunch of people that are going to listen. And of course, Cheryl is going to send you, she wants you to send her Dark Light Dawn. And she wants his T1 Strong to the Bone. You know, if I just, all I have to do is say I read it and I love it. And you know that Partners in Crime is going to want it. So thank you both so very much. And
thank
John,
you,
how is the weather? Is the weather any better out there? Is it still dark?
Yeah, the sun's back out. The interview's over. We survived the interview. The forces of nature are letting us go on and see another day.
Well, you see, I told you that my sister controls the weather, so she's not going to make it quite too hard. It's dark here, but I'm hoping that it gets sunny and we have a little light. But thank you very much. And John, whenever you're ready to schedule an interview for Strong to the Bone, let me know, because by the time next week comes, you never know. October and November are done. September's done. So let me know what date works for you in December before
Absolutely.
I give it away. Okay? Thank you for being
All right.
show, and
thank
I can't wait
so
to
much,
do this
friend.
Again. You're welcome. Everybody have a nice day, and bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.